Hello, Voices of Wrestling listener. Dave Ryan here. Have you ever wondered to yourself how many hidden gems are hidden away inside the last years of World Championship Wrestling? Have you ever asked yourself how many tenuous gags can be made about the name Mike Enos? And have you ever thought about what it sounds like for two Irishmen to interpret a very chaotic company through its B-show? The answers to all this and more are just a click away. Check out Days of Thunder every second Thursday on the Voices of Wrestling podcast network.
Hey everybody, my name is Jesse Collins and I am the host of the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast, a show right here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. On the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast, we take a deep look at individual issues and stories that are going on in the wrestling world. Each episode is about a different topic and we take a thorough and educated look at things ranging from current booking trends to breakdowns on individual performers and angles to investigations into different fan cultures across the industry. In addition, we keep a close eye on the wrestling media, and as a professional journalist, I bring a unique perspective to how current issues in wrestling are being covered and discussed through the wrestling media. We have a revolving series of guests from across wrestling punditry joining us on each episode, and we hope that you make the choice to give us a listen on wherever you get your podcast from.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
To the highway, in a brand new day, over the rainbow, gotta let it go. So far, is a car. Fast to freedom,
stars tonight.
Welcome back to the Voice Gate for November 18th, 2025. We are members of the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. You can find us on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network feed or on our own dedicated Open the Voice Gate feed, wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us on social media at Open Voice Gate. And if you'd like to donate to the show, click the link in the show notes. It'll take you to our redcircle.com landing site. You click the red box that says sponsor this podcast. And it's about one-time or reoccurring donation, no obligation whatsoever, but we would like to thank all of our previous donors. I'm one of your hosts, it's your old pal Mike Spears, joined alongside as always Case Lowe. And Case, we're just going to get right into this with a non-Dragon Gate topic, but kind of Dragon Gate, and then we'll get into what's gone on through the week. The Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame results came out last Friday. We talked during our Mochizuki show about how we were going with it and where we kind of finished up being. But buddy, how are you doing and what are your thoughts of this? We really haven't had a chance to talk about how this all kind of shook out.
Yeah, no, we haven't really talked. We didn't talk over the weekend, so we have not had a chance to discuss the Hall of Fame stuff. I find the entire ballot to be extremely interesting. You know, I think for the sake of this podcast, we're going to talk about Hamada, we're going to talk about Mochizuki, and then I want to talk about Sasuke a little bit, getting back on the ballot at the end of this. But, you know, big picture thoughts, I feel slightly vindicated. Perhaps I'm going to take too much credit for this. I don't want to come across indignant by any means, but I think Grant Hamada being in the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame has righted a very big wrong. My only complaint there is that I wish this would have happened last year while he was still alive, because I think in the same way that Roy Lucier has a very tight relationship with Doral Dixon, who also got in, and that was the other person in the Mexico category that I voted for, you know, Roy was able to inform Dixon of the fact that he was voted into this sort of abstract Hall of Fame. And had Hamada been alive, I think we know enough people and are connected to enough people, and there's enough of a thread between the Hall of Fame and the world of Lucha Libre that we would have, somebody would have been able to have contacted Gran Hamada. And the fact that that didn't happen is something that I've thought about a lot, just on a human level, as for whatever reason, for the last 3 or 4 months, I've been far more introspective, i.e. annoying than normal. But I've just been thinking about the life and the death of Gran Hamada, and him not seeing himself in the Hall of Fame has not bugged me in the way that I'm annoyed at people, but it saddened me a little bit. But for him to finish as highly as he did, to get in, it makes me very, very happy.
Yeah, Hamada ends up getting 179 votes in the Mexico category. That gets him in at 75%, which I did not realize was such a huge accomplishment until I was like reading down into the Observer. And Hamada is one of, I think, I'm not going to try to count on air, but about two dozen people who ended up getting that way. Spiros Arion, the number one vote getter this year, getting there as well. And it feels like it rights some wrongs, but I kept on going back to like the human element and the not to like sound like I have any like real skin in the game here, but like I thought it was so awesome that Roy was able to tell Darrell Dixon. I thought that, especially seeing that this was something that Darrell Dixon valued, and especially reaching a certain age and being able to sit back and say, like, yeah, not only did I feel like I accomplished something, here's the confirmation of that. And not having that for Hamada, especially kind of given the way that his life and career went, it's kind of fitting that it's post-death, but it's a little bittersweet.
No, you're exactly right. It's sort of the more on brand thing for Hamada to have happened. And you know, that's the one thing I was thinking about, and this has sort of been a thought in the back of my mind this entire year, because when he passed, that was in February, and I remember really hoping that we were going to unlock some treasure trove of Hamada footage, and that hasn't really happened. I mean, I think there's a handful of uploads between the stuff that Rob Viper has been uploading on his YouTube channel all year, which those have been some of my favorite uploads, just to look at, like, oh, this Monterey 2001 TV lineup got posted. Let me just look at the lineup there. It's not stuff that I'm spending a ton of time on, but I do enjoy tracking what has been uploaded. But I think between Roy and Rob Viper, you know, we might have our hands on one or two new Hamada matches. So him getting in is a testament to, you know, I think the work that Cubs has done and the work that Rob Viper has done, and Rich and Joe have been very ardent Hamada supporters, and I would like to take a little bit of credit for that, especially the podcast we did with Cubs last year. But it's not coming off the back of like, oh, we have 15 new classic Hamada matches that the right people watched at the right time. This is still very much a legacy where most of the footage we have of him is him as an older man, somehow post-prime, when you think about how good he is, even in like 1996. You know, that's a guy who had been wrestling for 20 years at that point. And so I find that to be a little exciting. I find that to be a little interesting, just the idea that, you know, Hamada's getting in off of research and articles and podcasts and not necessarily footage, which is a nice thing to see, because, you know, we're now fully in an era of the Hall of Fame where, you know, we have these entire guys' career on tape, which is both a good thing, but I also think that, you know, a Hall of Fame is interesting. I was just talking about this with somebody where I'm now at a point in the Baseball Hall of Fame where there are guys getting in where I watched their entire careers in real time, and that's new for me.
So the passage of time has finally caught up to you right now.
A little bit. Yeah. I'm trying to think who went in this year that really caught me off guard. It was CC Sabathia, where, I don't want to say I watched his entire career, but I had takes on CC Sabathia in real time. That's a guy where I watched an overwhelming majority of his career, and it's not that he was or wasn't a Hall of Famer, but it was just strange for me seeing him get in where it's like, oh yeah, that's, you know, that's not Mickey Mantle, that's not Stan Musial, that's not somebody with a legacy larger than life. Like, that's just CC Sabathia. Like, I watched the guy get shelled in the playoffs year after year. He never showed up when it counted, but he is a Hall of Fame pitcher. And so now I think we're hitting this point with the Observer Hall of Fame where we have just an overwhelming amount of footage of some of these guys, and it's going to change the way we look at what is and isn't a Hall of Famer. And I think that's a very interesting thing. Hamada is sort of the one of the last of a dying breed of guys that are going to get in where we don't have a majority of their career on tape.
Yeah, and funny enough about CC Sabathia, he is the first Baseball Hall of Fame inductee who was born in the 80s. So,
oh, that's a good that's a good trivia question.
Yeah, because I was as soon as you started talking about it, I was like, is he the youngest person in the Hall of Fame? And of course, Baseball Reference quickly did it according to like when you judge Adrian Beltre's birthday.
Well, I do not trust whatever that answer is, so I will side with CC Sabathia.
they are technically listing Adrian Beltre's birthday as 79, and of course, he was like one of the first age conspiracy people. So I think that's what it ended up actually being. I think they technically said that he was, or they claimed that he was like 77 or something, and that was the whole issue that the Dodgers got in trouble with him, like that he signed below 16.
That sounds about right. Other things that caught my eye here before we get to Mochizuki, I, despite the fact that I am so sick of him as a person, I am glad that CM Punk is now in the Hall of Fame. I have said for you, I would have voted for Punk had he never stepped foot in AEW. I thought he was an obvious Hall of Famer before that AEW run, but I did not have a ballot until 2022, so that would have been kind of right as things were blowing up. So I never.
I have audio of you saying that you would have voted for him at on one of the E Patreon.
Oh my god, yes!
So
I remember. Yeah, I remember having this conversation with Aaron Bentley. I find Punk's WWE run to his first one to be underappreciated. I think people make a little bit too much of the summer of Punk stuff and not a big enough deal about some of the 2012 and 2013 statistics.
Things of that nature, of course.
Yes. You know, straight edge society, yada, yada, yada. But you know, that later run, yeah. I really think he is the closest we get to a macho man to John Cena as Hulk Hogan. And I'm not sure that has been properly reflected with the Observer Hall of Fame pool. And then obviously, you know, post AEW, I found it insane that he wasn't already in. So I'm glad that Punk got in. It looks like Hayabusa is going to get in next year. Yeah. I'm not going to get upset about that. I personally don't get the Hayabusa thing the way everybody else does. I think that is a Hall of Very Good guy, not a Hall of Famer, but I could change my opinion in a year if I really sit down and think about it. The Zack Sabre Jr. percentage is the one that really, really caught me off guard. He finished with 49.7% of the vote. And this is going to be one that I'm going to put up a little bit of a fight on because I adore Zack Sabre Jr. I mean, I think he's probably one of the 50 best wrestlers of all time. And Zack was somebody that I think outside of England, I feel like I was a little hip to Zack before a lot of people were because I was watching Evolve before Evolve got hot when Zack was there and had moved to America and made that his primary focus. And, you know, I was a big fan of his work in WXW before that. And that was all stuff that was very much in my wheelhouse. But there is no part of me that thinks that the story of professional wrestling needs to include Zack Sabre Jr. And I am stunned that he finished that highly this year.
Yeah, I guess like my big takeaways are like the ones that got inducted, they fall really into two camps. You have the Hamada, Arian, Dixon, Bruns camp of the ones where like the research bared out, and I'd argue that Bobby Bruns should have been a fiat pick from the jump given how responsible he is for the Puroso scene and Ricky Dozen. But and then you have the ones like Punk, Cody, and Sabu that very much feel like us kind of like making terms of the recent past and present. And I feel at least for like someone like Zack Sabre Jr., unless you are someone who's going to do the Rich Krejci, I believe he's one of the X amount of best wrestlers of all time. Of course, he has to be in the Hall of Fame. That's kind of where I am for Mochizuki, just putting my cards out there, to be quite honest. But like outside of that, like there's a big part of me, especially considering how that region's going to get next year, that I think 49.7 might be a high point for him until his career kind of actually winds down just because of how much of a glut that category is going to be in 2026. Like, I can't see him getting in at this point. Whereas Hayabusa, realistically, I mean, 189 voters in the Japanese region, he got 185. That's just a handful of people who do like a coin flip decision. I was a coin flip decision at the end of the day for voting for Hayabusa case. Like that, those are the ones that you kind of go like, that's going to bear out. But Zack Sabre Jr., I really think that this is going to be a peak for him in voting. And then it's going to be a couple of real cold years coming out of it just because of how that category is going to get.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it from that perspective, but I think you're probably right there. It sort of goes to that thing that I talked about right before ballots were due, where I did feel like people were going to vote for Zach just because human instinct is to vote for somebody, you know, vote for the most qualified person in that category. And for a lot of people, that is Zack Sabre Jr. Now, I think the head-to-head comparison with Mochizuki and Sabre is one that benefits Mochizuki entirely. You know, I think as much as I love Zach's work, and again, I feel very comfortable saying outside of the last two or three years of New Japan, I have watched a very large bulk of Zack Sabre Jr.'s career, and especially when it comes to the mid-2010s European indie stuff and all of his U.S. indie stuff, I feel like I have seen as much, if not more, than most of the Observer Hall of Fame voting base. But Mochizuki has a far better in-ring career. I feel like, in the way that I look at drawing, and I always say this, I think drawing has to be contextualized. You know, Mochizuki was on top for three of the four true hot periods in Dragon Gate history. Zach has been on top for a famously cold period in New Japan history. So I give the edge to Mochizuki there. And I find their influence category to be very similar in that they have very little to no influence. There's nobody wrestling like Mochizuki. There's nobody wrestling like Zack Sabre Jr. I was very, very surprised to see Zach that high.
Go ahead. Just to jump in kind of a little quick here about this. I think that the business case for Zach actually gets worse today because of the Bushiroad Financial saying that New Japan was essentially flat this year.
I don't think there's a positive to Zack Sabre Jr. as a box office candidate. I mean, maybe
outside of Europe and outside of a couple Europe shows, like, I think you've heard my spiel about how I think Evolve is big noise but a little data to back it up business wise for him and stuff like that. Like, he doesn't have a business case whatsoever.
No, and I'm somebody who is very much of the belief, and I'll talk about this with Sabu and the Briscoes and Samoa Joe in a second, but like, you know, Zach popping a notable Rev Pro house or a notable Progress house, that stuff matters to me. And I don't like the way that is discounted. I always think that's really unfair, but that's kind of what we're looking at with Zach here. Unless I'm forgetting, I mean, maybe the first Okada Zach match, which was April of 2017, it's a top 10 Okada match for me of all time. I still have it burned into my brain as to how good that match was, or I guess it was April 2018, but you know, maybe that did a great house, but that was also, you're talking about Okada at the height of his powers there. So that's an Okada house, not a Zack Sabre Jr. house. It's one of those things. It's a bummer because I love Zach, and historically I kind of think he's underrated, but I don't find him to be fit for this Hall of Fame whatsoever. Sabu getting in was very nice to see. I was on the fence for him at the start of balloting this year. And then listening to specifically Rich and Joe, but specifically Rich, make the argument that this Hall of Fame should award people that are unique and award individuality really put me over the hill for Sabu. And I just wish, although they did not change wrestling in the way that Sabu did, because Sabu did greatly change wrestling, I wish people would embrace the same part of their brain they used to vote for Sabu, for Samoa Joe, and for the Briscoe brothers. I was delighted to see that the Briscoe brothers number was where it was at this year, but still, I find this Hall of Fame to be increasingly annoying with no Samoa Joe and no Briscoes, and hopefully next year I have more time to sit down and write some thoughts. I think it's time that I really, in the same way that now 6 years ago, I dove into the careers of the Young Bucks and anointed them the greatest tag team of all time, which is a take that has aged so wonderfully in the last 6 years. I think it's time I sit down and really do some Briscoe Brothers work and try to explain to people how great this tag team was, because I still don't think people get it.
Yeah, and it's something that the more I think about it and the more I think about the Briscoes, the more obvious it is to me. You know, the one that kind of I feel like is like, come on, guys, you've got to get over the hump with are some of these historical and non-wrestlers that just I almost feel like that for like some of these people like Ted Turner, that is just like, come on. People need to kind of just get over the personality basis of it and just kind of do that. And I think the Briscoes, similarly, when you especially you look at the tag team of their tenure and you look at Ring of Honor and how much like for it ends up being another referendum for Ring of Honor that I think is happening with those two candidates, to be quite honest. But I think you have to start really looking at like the Briscoes, especially with what they did in the company. And then after the end of Sinclair Ring of Honor, I mean, look at that kind of stretch that they had kind of being a barnstorming tag team, showing up in Impact, doing all the other stuff too. I think it's such a slam dunk case that what will frustrate me are the people that go like, oh no, instead of Mark and Jay Briscoe, let's talk about the Usos as candidates, because that's going to happen real soon. Case like, just mentally prepare yourself for the Jimmy and Jay Uso conversation that's going to happen in 2035.
I think I would have been more worried about that had you said that to me at this time last year. But I think whatever the solo Uso that's getting the big push that has all the bad matches, and I gun to my head, could not tell you which one. I don't know which one that is.
You got to get caught up. We know Allen's already doing his prep. Like, we cannot be going in weak and let Allen win one of these five-star match games again, man. I need you to get in on your WWE, and you need to catch up on the Yeet Man.
I don't even get me started on the bullshit that Allen's going to pull this year on five-star match game. 2025, the year that I've watched less wrestling than I have since 2013, when I was really getting back into wrestling and diving into the indies and getting into Japan for the first time, I've watched less wrestling this year than any year in the last 12 years. There's even, and you know, please don't tell my close personal friend TK this, but like, I didn't know Full Gear was on Saturday. I have no idea what's on that card. I haven't watched Dynamite in almost 2 months now. I don't know what's happening, and I need to do a crash course because I'm starting to get hit up by AWPR people again. I'm like, oh, I gotta let me fire up that flagship Patreon, listen to a few TV reviews. I gotta really catch up on this. But you know, I mean, Alan's gonna rattle off his favorite Yeet Man matches, all of the Intercontinental Champions, all of the Women's United States Tag Team Champions, which I think is a real thing.
WWE Speed Champions, you know,
Speed Champion,
all of that.
You know,
Evolve.
Yes, Evolve. I saw somebody. God, can I find this real quick? Let me see if I can find this. And I shouldn't do this because it's mean, and I also know this person in real life, so I really shouldn't do this. But I saw somebody praising Maxine Dupree in a way that I thought was so annoying, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to find this take. Hold on, let me. Last week I failed to find the DVDVR post that I so desperately wanted to find. I'm going
to
see.
I can't. I can't read your brain this while you're on
okay,
your own.
I got it. Maxine Dupree winning the IC Championship, which apparently there's a Women's Intercontinental Championship, which I'm for. I love it, ladies, but I did not know that was a thing. Maxine Dupree winning the IC Championship, even with an AJ Lee distraction finish, which again. Okay, didn't know that was happening. Good to know. Even with an AJ Lee distraction finish, is a feel-good moment for sure. She may not be a technical dynamo, but she exhibits heart and intensity. Becky Lynch sold it like $1 million. Hashtag WWE Raw. Hashtag WWE. I gotta be honest, none of that sounds real. And I can't believe that somebody would say that Maxine Dupree exhibits heart and intensity.
Buddy, the only way I knew this happened was I was wondering why a AJ Lee clip was in my Instagram timeline until I scrolled up and I saw it was Akira Tozawa celebrating Maxine Dupree's Women's Intercontinental title win. That's how I knew that this happened.
I didn't know that AJ stuck around. I know she did the one gimmick tag, but I it's news to, is she just back on TV full time?
I think so. They were at the Garden last night. So like Brock was there, like they filled it up.
Well, it's nice to know that AJ Lee and Phil Brooks are sticking by their guns and continuing to be not performative allies, but allies and wrestling on the same show that Brock Lesnar appeared on. You know, the nice thing about them is that you never have to doubt what their intentions are, and they're not completely full of shit all the time. So once again, shout out to Chicago's favorite son, Phil Brooks. He seems like such a nice, normal-headed, level-headed guy and isn't completely full of shit at all times. Masaki Mochizuki finished with 21% of the vote in his first year on the Observer Hall of Fame. This is both a gift and a curse. It is nice that he finished with 21%. He will never do better than this, and it means that we will once again have to talk about Masaki Mochizuki possibly getting into the Hall of Fame next year, even though he has no shot.
Yeah, I'm just going to tell Rich just to re-upload that episode.
Yeah,
so
we did our work. I love that podcast. I'm so proud of the work we did on Mochizuki. We can't do it better than that.
I mean, this is going to end up me, like, you know what this actually says? This means I'm actually going to go hand look up all of those shows that Chris Samsa gave me. No, like not the ones he just did in the main events, but like the three and six wave tags that were like over 600 of them, just to prove the point that he is a business draw. You know, like that's what it means for me.
Knock yourself out. I will not be doing that. I will be re-uploading last year's podcast. I tell you, I got nothing left in the tank on Mochizuki discourse. But
yeah,
the Japanese category, man, higher than I thought. It's, you know, good for him.
Yeah, no, he's sticking around. Also, a lot of people in Japan, no one in the Japanese category dropped Gaze. So Satoshi Kojima and Hiroshi Tenjin will be on the ballot next year. Antonio Inoki, Seiji Sakaguchi will be on the ballot again next year. Mako Satomura will be on the ballot again next year. Yoshihiro Takayama will be on the ballot again next year. Io Shirai / Io Sky will be on the ballot again next year. Zack Sabre Jr. will be on the ballot. Adding to this category will be Kyoko Inoue, Tom Nakano, Kenta, and the great Sasuke, Case.
Well, let's start with Tom Nakano. Obviously, I'm very excited for Modern Joshi and Modern Joshi fans to get in on the action here. I'm sure they won't be throwing personal attacks my way or anybody else's way.
Yeah.
And I look forward to really healthy discussion from all of the Modern Joshi fans that won't be overreacting for 2 or 3 years of good business. So that will be very fun. I look forward to being called a sexist pig next year when Observer Hall of Fame season comes around. Kenta, I will be voting for. My ballot next year will absolutely include Kenta and Masaki Mochizuki. I think Mochizuki is one of the 10 greatest wrestlers of all time. I think Kenta is one of the 15 greatest wrestlers of all time. I am intrigued to dig into Kenta as a draw because I think there's a very good possibility we make too much of the one bomb with Marufuji and ignore many of his highlights. One of those being, and this goes back to my Samoa Joe Briscoe's kind of Sabu point, where I think undeniably, Kenta was a massive Ring of Honor star in 2006.
Yeah,
possibly the biggest draw in the company at the time when it was most critically acclaimed. And I do think that matters. It is not something that should automatically put him in the Hall of Fame. But I'm looking forward to doing a little bit of Kenta stuff next year because I'm afraid that we overinflate the one Marufuji house and don't give credit to some of the other stuff that he might deserve credit for.
Yeah, I think really when you're like looking at like that time period, he has so much I feel like it will be very easy for people lumping in with Marufuji, whereas I think like Kenta with that Ring of Honor time period, and even, I mean, he has drawn some indie houses and other stuff outside
and
of that.
Some New Japan houses. You can't forget the New Japan stuff.
Yeah, so I think he's kind of a sneaky one. I'll say this right now. I am not one way or another on Great Sasuke yet, and I feel like the next year's worth of Those Days episode will probably slant me one way or the other by the time that the balloting comes around next October. We'll be like almost into 1997 at that point, too.
Oh, God willing, yes. Once I get through, I got about another month of a really, really busy work schedule, and then it slows down and my personal life is in a lull right now. So we're bringing back those days next week, and then hopefully 2026 we'll be able to fire up some more at a more frequent pace. But we're getting one in November, and we'll get one in December, and we'll go from there. One more thing on Kenta that I obviously want to talk about Sasuke here. Thing with Kenta, and I remember the first time I did Greatest Wrestler Ever, and even the second time with you and Alan, I remember having a hard time with Ibushi, because there's something about Kota Ibushi where there have been times where I've watched him at a high level and I've been convinced that he is the most talented wrestler that I've ever seen. And I kind of feel that way about Prime Kenta too, where there are matches from 04 to 09, and then again that super underrated GHC Heavyweight Championship reign he had in 2013 and 2014, right before he left the company, Noah, where he might have the highest ceiling of anybody other than maybe his namesake in Kenta Kobashi. The Kenta thing, I mean, again, I could close my eyes tomorrow. He's a Hall of Famer in my book. I don't have to think about it, because I think he's one of the 15 greatest wrestlers ever. But there is like a higher level with him where I go, not only is he one of the 15 greatest wrestlers ever, at his peak, he might be the best wrestler I've ever seen.
Yeah, like I just, my brain, whenever I think about Kenta, goes to places where it's like, oh yeah, the Ricky Marvin match. Like that to me, that still might be the most perfect 3.5 minutes of wrestling history. Like it just like you have someone who was able to like put it together on so many different levels and so many different aspects of in-ring work that to me, the more I think about it, the more I go like, yeah, no, I mean, 2006 Kenta was a different kind of creature. And at least for me, and in the way I look at these Hall of Fames, that there's a place for that just as much as there's a place for Sabu to completely change the wrestling world. I do feel like that you look at especially that junior heavyweight style that he did and how right as his peak was really kind of kicking off, how that really trickled down to the indies. Like you were seeing people already like 4 or 5 years into it, like your Davey Richards at one point basically like outright just be Kentas. And I think that someone who has that much of an impact on the industry, even if it feels like that it's that I'm kind of mining for something here, I think that you take a look at when Kenta really was hitting his peak, and especially the junior heavyweights that came immediately after that, and I think he ends up becoming one of the more influential wrestlers of that era. Really?
Oh, I mean, Kenta changed wrestling. I don't think that's a question. And I think he changed it for the better. And one of the, you know, it's like we said the thing last week, we had the conversation about, you know, some of the people that would like Dragon Gate the most are the people that write off Dragon Gate the most. And they, you know, they don't really know what they're missing. And without getting too uppity about it, because I don't want to specifically label Sugu Nakeda as the biggest antagonist in the situation, but there's like a, you know, that corner of the internet, the you know, pro wrestling only Sugu Nakeda, that type of person that has for whatever reason written off Kenta, it's one of the more dumbfounding opinions. There's not a wrestler that at his peak was more intense, wrestled with more heart, and had more passion than this guy. And I often find that if you're going to praise a match from Futen, you would like the same things that Kenta was doing in Noah. And there's 25 obvious matches you could throw people's way that I think would demonstrate. Because I think that's the other thing now with Kenta is we've been dealing. I mean, Kenta left Noah for the first time 11 years ago. It was Hulk Hogan that announced that Kenta was signing with the WWE. So there's
Yeah.
I see that photo and I stop in my tracks every time I see it. I can't believe it.
I still think about him introducing Prince Devitt and them doing the big name change, the kind of thing for both of them.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. I mean, that's ancient history that I would say we have far more people listening to this podcast that didn't experience any of Kenta's Noah run, his first Noah run in real time. Because even like me, I got so into his GHC heavyweight title run in 2013, the match with Segura, He's got a Nagata match that I really like. Maybe a tag, but you know, he's got like a late stage Morishima match that's really, really good. So even I caught the back end of that, but that's so long ago now, and you forget that, you know, there's all these Kenta hidden gems. I mean, one of my favorite tag matches ever is Goshi Ozaki and Kenta versus Kensuke Sasaki and Katsuhiko Nakajima from June 22nd, 2009. That's a five-star match to me, and it's sort of the forgotten gem of the Kenta-Nakajima feud, because everybody points to the singles matches and then the gauntlet match from Diamond Ring, and they forget about that tag, and that tag is better than any of those. It's the best thing from the feud. You know, when he's got an Akiyama singles match from 2009 that is so great. He's got a Kensuke Sasaki singles match from 2008 that's so great. There's a Kenta Kobashi and Kenta versus Kensuke Sasaki and Katsuhiko Nakajima match from 2008 that's so great. There's like an all-time hidden gem. Let me get the date on this. I want to make sure that I've got the right date on this, because this is a true under-the-radar Sicko Noah match recommendation, but I want to make sure that people, if they can find it, that they see it. I got to find the right spreadsheet here. This was from 2008, and the match is... Kenta's not in that. Never mind. It's a six-man tag that I'm thinking about, but he's not in it. That sucks. Ah, damn it. I was thinking, for those who are wondering, it's Kenta Kobashi, Shohei Taniguchi, and Tomon Honda versus Naomichi Marufuji, Takeshi Morishima, and Takashi Sugura from February 21st, 2008. It's one of the best matches of 2008, and I don't know if anybody remembers that match. I'm assuming most people haven't seen that match. You wouldn't fucking believe how good it is. Like, it's no reason to be that good, but I was looking, I'm on the old Ditch site, and I was looking at...
Do the kids know about Tomon Honda?
I don't feel like they know about high-level Tomon Honda. That feels like something that would have been completely lost to the wayside. Years and years ago, but I was looking at the Ditch site, and there's a Kobashi, Honda, and Kenta versus Takayama, Sano, and Shiozaki match from April of that year, and I was like, that doesn't seem right. I don't remember Takayama being in the match that I liked so much. Turns out Kenta wasn't in the match that I liked so much either, so you can scratch that one from the record. But my point is, if there's 25 obvious Kenta match recommendations, I can give you another 30 under the radar Kenta match recommendations just from Noah, let alone like the Matt Sydal match in Ring of Honor that I think is crazy underrated, or you know, the three-way match with Joe and Danielson that I still really, really like. He's one of the greatest wrestlers to ever do it. Yeah, I think the world of him, and I don't think he's going to fare too well, and I think that's a real bummer, because much like Mochizuki, it's just like, that. It's Kenta. That's the argument. It's Kenta. He's Pro Wrestling Observer, Hall of Famer.
No, I'm with you on that. Sasuke, we didn't really touch on too much. I'm still kind of open to discussions in every sort of way for him. And I'm seeing how our studies over the next year kind of changes that, especially going to like 90, 95 and 96 in depth. Where are you at with great Sasuke today?
So I've been asking for Sasuke on the ballot for a few years now. The last few years where I've submitted a ballot, I have asked Dave for the great Sasuke, I have asked Dave for Kenta, and I have asked Dave for Gabe Sapolsky. And I don't get the impression that Gabe is ever going to go on. Gabe is, again, somebody that I think Gabe, actually, of the three names of Kenta, Sasuke, and Gabe Sapolsky, I think Gabe might be the one that I feel strongest about going in. But I'm on the fence with Sasuke as well. I don't know if I'm going to vote for him. Sasuke was on the ballot once in 2004. He got less than 10% of the vote. That's the same year that Ultimo Dragon went into the Hall of Fame, which I've always found to be very interesting. The thing with Sasuke and why I want to re-examine him is really far less to do with any of his in-ring work. It's not that I don't care about that. And as we've gone through those days thus far, he's actually a better wrestler than I was expecting him to be, and I've enjoyed his matches more than I thought I would. But Sasuke forming Michinoku Pro, the first wrestling organization in Japan to be based outside of Tokyo, and to have a business run from, let's say, 1994, you know, kind of the those days timeline, you know, 1993 to 2000, forget what has ever come after that. I just think that's worth taking another look at. And so the thing with Sasuke is obviously he's going to be categorized as an active wrestler in the Japan region, region, and he should be. But I'm way more interested in the non-wrestler side of Sasuke than I am the wrestler side for this Observer Hall of Fame. And I feel like, given the guidelines that we have, that I'm okay to factor that stuff in to whether or not I think he should be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, no, it's really figuring out how to deal with those two kind of facets of the same person in this. Like, the more that I kind of go into like my own research and going for Sasuke, it does feel like to me that side really has to be considered, because you're not putting him on the ballot just as himself as the wrestler. You have the whole package there. I mean, it's the same thing of Hayabusa. It's the whole package with Hayabusa on the ballot. Like, you have to consider kind of all aspects of them, I feel like, at least. But I'm still kind of,
you know, as we talk about representation and what it means for the Lucha Wrestling style of wrestling, you know, you had Alto get in there in 2004, and I mean, I certainly don't think Ultimo is the weakest candidate now, because you have Shinsuke Nakamura in there and, you know, depending on what day you ask me, Roman Reigns. But I still think Ultimo is a Hall of Famer. You've got Shima in there now. You have Shingo in there, but Shingo doesn't get in without the New Japan stuff. So you sort of put him as a Lucha Wrestling asterisk. And so now what you're missing is Michinoku Pro. And if you want to convince yourself to vote for Sasuke as a vote for Michinoku Pro, the entity, I'm not going to fight you on that, because I don't think Shinzaki is worth discussing. I don't think Delphin is worth discussing. I don't think Dick Togo is worth discussing. But if you're a believer that Sasuke being in the Hall of Fame is not only a vote for Sasuke, but it's a vote for a highly influential and at one point commercially viable pro wrestling organization, then I would certainly hear that argument. I'm not sure I'm there, but I understand why some people would be.
Yeah, and fortunately for us, we still have, well, about 360 days before, or 358 days before we have to make that decision. Well, okay, should we talk about what's gone on in Dragon Gate this week?
Yes, we should.
So, as we were talking about last week, we are in the depths of King of Gate season, and four matches from Yokosuka, as well as, where is the other one from on the top? I'm looking through my notebooks for what I had it for it. Oh, Yokosuka and Nagoya. We have four matches from King of Gate there. The show from Shizuoka that kicked off the second round has not been uploaded yet to the Dragon Gate network, but also we have the Gate of Nostalgia one-off show that happened yesterday at Shinjuku Face. And it's an interesting kind of time, just because all of this tournament's kind of happening, and then it does kind of feel like it's fits and starts. But at the very least, like, talking about King of Gate right now, we did come away with one of the top matches of the tournament over the weekend in Yokosuka. At least
I thought we had two gems, and obviously you're referring to Susumu Kosuka versus Ben K, and we can start with that. But I do want to mention Mochizuki Jr. versus Yoshiki Kato being a step below Yokosuka versus Ben, but I don't think a giant step below Yokosuka versus Ben.
No. I had Yokosuka versus Ben at 4.25, and I had Jr. versus Kato at 3.5. So just that step below, basically. But yeah, let's actually go to Nagoya first in those two matches, Junior versus Kato and UT versus Takashi. And let's do it chronologically. Yoshiki Kato defeats Mochizuki Jr. with the Caldera Luna backbreaker to advance onwards. And really what I feel like the best chemistry of people in the new generation kind of put on display again. Kato has been amazing. I have some big Kato thoughts from Gate of Nostalgia, but him versus Junior and the way that Junior works as Babyface in Peril, that was good stuff in Nagoya.
I made the comment in the Dragon Gate channel on the Voices of Wrestling Discord this week, and I really don't think there's a larger discussion to have, but I just find it so interesting that Masaki Mochizuki, it's, you know, 31 years of being a stoic Iron Man that never breaks, and he's known far more for his devastating offense than he is looking like a face in peril. And his son is the most emotional babyface seller that there is. You know, they could not be more opposite in what makes them great, and yet they're still both entirely great. And there's a reason they continue to put Mochizuki Jr. and Kato in the ring with one another. They bring out the best in each other. This is a long-term rivalry. It's one I enjoy anytime these two go at it. And I thought this match was really, really close to being 4 stars. I was at 3 3/4 with it. I loved it. There's just some integral stuff here. You know, Kato going for a big boot, Junior countering it with an ankle pick and then turning that into an ankle lock. The way he was able to get on the mat so quick, I thought that was great. I thought all of their strikes looked absolutely devastating in this match in a really, really good way. And then as this match heads down the stretch, Mochizuki Jr. goes for a German. His back gives out. And I thought the way that he sold it, the way that he absolutely crumpled to the mat was incredible. Very small thing there added a ton to the match. Kato was able to come back from that and kill this guy with a lariat. Mochizuki came back with a brutal roundhouse at one point. Kato would respond to that with another lariat. And then from there, he folded Junior in half, hit him with the blood fall, and won the match. Again, this was very close to being notebook for me. Kato, I think, has really had a sneaky great back half of 2025. This is a guy who I preached patience with. I said the reason they weren't doing anything with him for a while was there was just nowhere to put him. And now that they have a spot to push him, I think he's risen to the occasion. I've been a huge fan of the work that he's done lately.
He has really, like, the big man heel. He has figured it all out.
Don't you feel like you don't have to worry about him anymore?
No, I'm now just genuinely excited to see him work. And I thought that he just was, like, so effective getting the back work over on Junior, who is one of the better sellers in the company. I mean, the only thing that this match was missing out of the Mochizuki Junior playbook was bust your nose open, bleed a bunch, and fire up and get this. But the back selling, the way that they kind of worked towards that and into the closing stretch, I loved how the Junior, realizing his back was giving out, was going, well, I'm just going to have to kick him. And he tries for his hurricane kick. And that was immediately ducked down into it, just an obliterating lariat into the finish. And Kato had another moment like that at Gate of Nostalgia, where I just kind of sat there going, Yoshiki Kato is a bad man. And it's really a lot of fun to see. So Kato, after winning this match, he goes on to face El Cielo, and really one of the big coin flips of the tournament. I feel like Kato is looking real strong and has been protected very well going up against El Cielo, who might be the most protected person in this entire bracket.
I'm going to be so curious to see that match based on what I just said about how you don't have to worry about Yoshiki Kato anymore, and yet his match following the Junior match, the person he has the best chemistry with, is a massive question mark. So that will be very interesting to see.
That match will be coming this Sunday in Fukuoka, not across Fukuoka. This is another venue in the prefecture that will be one of the two second round matches on that show. UT versus Takashi. Yes, this was a UT homecoming show, so you had airs of that going throughout. But this one, at least for me, as like the big UT, as one of the big UT guys, this felt like more of a Takashi match than a UT one. The work was there, I thought, was genuinely good enough. UT gets the win in his hometown to advance to the second round, in which UT will be facing on, or face off rather, against Yuki Yoshioka.
I think this match is still going. I think Takashi Yoshida has worked for 5 days straight on UT, because I found this to be a completely endless match that overstayed its welcome almost immediately. And I thought UT worked hard, but oh my God, when I do a tournament power ranking, this is at the bottom of the list. Holy shit, did I hate this match. It wasn't bad. It was just, God, it was so long.
Yeah, and it was not UT then deciding to use Takashi as a human jungle gym and stretch him out. It was him trying to find the moment to get the Bien Yave and escape. So just kind of groaned on from there. Let's move on to Yokosuka. We have Masaaki Mochizuki in the situation with his first round match, and then the Susumu Yokosuka and Benkei hometown main event. So before we get into this, Kota Minoura was pulled from the tournament due to a concussion. And it looked like that this was going to be a walkover in Yokosuka. Mochizuki was just going to be awarded the win and would be able to advance on. But instead, Ginki Horiguchi came out and said, hey, I'll have this match against you. I want a shot here. And then you instantly had a new first round matchup. We had two of them in Yokosuka, Genki Horiguchi versus Masaki Mochizuki in Case. The Mad Lad did it. Backslide out of a triangle kick to get the win. We might be having, it's 13 years later, Case, but we might be having a revival of the King of Gate 2012 Genki Horiguchi.
Well, the great thing about the Horiguchi inclusion is not only that, you know, seeing that result when I got up that day, for as much as I think I would have enjoyed Mochizuki versus Minoru, at the very least, that would have been a really interesting match to watch unfold. Having Horiguchi in and having him beat Mochizuki is one thing. But now you move on to a future where his next match is against Shun Skywalker. And if you told me that Genki was going to beat Shun with a backslide from heaven, I couldn't tell you you're an idiot. I think there's a real possibility that happens. And all of a sudden, as is anytime he's in King of Gate, Genki Horiguchi, to me, has become one of the most interesting subplots in this tournament.
Yeah, anyone who had a bet down on Kalshi or wherever that offers King of Gate that had Shun Skywalker to win it must have just, when they woke up and saw that result, must have gone like, well, piss, there goes that ticket. Because, yeah, I could very easily say Genki Horiguchi, let me see where he's facing Shun. It got announced today, all the second round matchups. It's on Monday in Izuka City. I can see Genki getting the win there and then facing off against Yuki Yoshioka in the quarterfinals, Case.
Would not shock me at all. Shock me at all.
And it was a fun little match that, like, as soon as, like, sadly, as soon as, like, we heard about this match, we knew, oh, Genki Horiguchi won by a backslide. But so it kind of pulled that kind of surprise out of the hand. But I thought that this was a perfectly fine kind of, oh my god, Genki's in this, oh my god, he's going for backslides, and you hear the crowd more and more realize that this is going to be a Genki Horiguchi backslide from heaven match. And that was kind of a cool experience to kind of see go throughout the crowd throughout the 7 minutes of the match.
It was both the floor and the ceiling of what I need from a Genki Horiguchi King of Gate match. I really, in 2025, I don't need anything more, I don't need anything less. This was at a perfectly fine level, and I was very happy with the result.
Absolutely. And then we had the Susumu Yokosuka versus Benkei homecoming match, the last match of the first round of King of Gate 2025. And the hometown guy does it. He survives an immediate spear in the first second of the match to claw back and gets it done with the Jumbo no Kachi. Susumu Yokosuka versus Benkei was as what you want to see in a hometown match. You got to see Benkei acting a little bit more heelish than you would expect, and not like heel Benkei, but more of like kind of like touring like star in a hometown healing, which is something that I don't think I've really seen out of Benkei that often.
I liked this match so much because one of the big discoveries we made in 2022 and 2023 when they were doing the YouTube uploads was it sort of dispelled the narrative of the Dragon Gate house show, which I think, you know, on these house shows, they would have every right to mail it in and not work super hard, given the schedule that they work for the shows that make TV. But what we saw on those house shows was, one, the unbelievable atmosphere of some of these homecoming shows. And as I always will repeat the line from a friend of ours who lives in Japan and goes to these shows, is that the homecoming shows are the best way to experience Dragon Gate in real person, in real life, in person. But also, there is just a shocking amount of effort in some of these matches done for 300, 400 people in a small town somewhere. And Benkei versus Susumu Yokosuka in Yokosuka was one of those matches where, you know, not only was it a great match and they did a bunch of work that I just really enjoyed, and that I you know, I think this match would have fit in All Japan. I think this would have fit in the peak of strong Big Japan. I think this would have been something that, you know, I think New Japan would kill for a straightforward match like this right now. But what jumped out to me was just the effort, you know, not the execution of everything, not the overall story that was told. Just the effort from move to move, I thought, was utterly incredible in this match. Well worth your time if you have not seen it.
Yeah, just Susumu is such an incredible babyface.
He's unbelievable. Just,
It's one of those things that you sit around and you watch and you go like, he is just like a different kind of pro wrestler. And I keep on kind of going back to like Ben kind of playing into it and how that kind of goes to it. And it added a little bit where if you squint and you look at it in a certain way, and maybe with some of the bad production that you get, you could almost like trick yourself a little bit to think that this is like a late aughts, early 2000s DGUSA or DGUK match in a way. And I thought that this was, I mean, I don't think anything is topping some of the stuff we've had so far in the tournament, but this is going to be one of the ones that, like, as we get down towards the final weeks of it, is going to be one of those matches that I'm going to look back at and think like, damn, they really did something amazing in Yokosuka. I still think Yamato versus Hyo might be my match of the tournament so far, but this is up there and it's neck and neck for me.
I would still have Shun Skywalker versus Naruki Doi at number one, Yamato versus Hyo at number two, and then this would be number three. Joe Gagne has the gif on his Twitter of the corner lariat from Yokosuka that caught Benkei's face more so than his neck, which was a pretty disgusting spot. And then there's the spot down the stretch where Susumu just absolutely clobbers Ben with the Jumbo Nokachi, and Ben pops up and hits an A-level Benkei spear on Yokosuka. That's the spot of the tournament for me, other than the Doi 5 counter into the blaster from Shun Skywalker that I continue to think about. A week and a half later, however long it's been. So a lot of good stuff in this match. Yeah, he deadlifted him in a butterfly suplex position. I have never seen anybody do that before.
Yeah, it's something else. And it is really one of those things that I'm so glad that we are getting that this way to see the tournament. I mean, seeing it all in general, but getting the hometown match like this one felt like something that was really kind of dear that we learned it was so important taken away from us, but fortunately for us, it is back. I'm going to run through what the tournament matches are going to be this weekend before we talk about Gate of Nostalgia, if that's okay.
Please.
All right, so the two matches that have not been uploaded yet are the second round matches between Yuki Yoshioka and UT, as well as Rita versus Kai. Those are from Shizuoka from Sunday. They have not been uploaded yet. It is also worth noting that it's been announced that Ryo Tanaka has forfeit his second round match and Yamato has received a bye into the quarterfinals. And then as we look to this week in the tournament matches, on Friday in Saga, we get KZ versus Johnny Valletta. And Saturday in Kudamoto, Genki Horiguchi's hometown, we get El Kakui versus Ishin. On Sunday in Fukuoka, there's two matches, El Cielo and Yoshiki Kato, and Jackie Kamei versus Asumi Yokosuka. That's main eventing the showcase. So just buckle in and get ready for that upload when that hits. And then the last King of Gate match that we have for this next loop is Genki Horiguchi versus Shun Skywalker in Izuka City and Fukuoka coming up on Monday. So by the time we are back talking about Dragon Gate in a few weeks, case, we will have the entirety of the second round and we'll be into the quarterfinals before we get back to Dragon Gate. So that is your card update, at least for the weekend. Let's talk about Gate of Nostalgia from yesterday in Shinjuku Face. I will have a written review. I actually basically finished it right before we hit record. That will be up on Voices of Wrestling tomorrow. But I think big picture wise, case, the show is exactly kind of what we were expecting. And a lot of kind of fun moments hitting on Dragon Gate nostalgia. But it, you know, the one thing that we learned is that this company will make Johnny Valletta basically plug himself into anything, and it will still be incredibly compelling because Johnny Valletta is Johnny Valletta.
I was thinking during this show, it's like, my God, you know who would have loved the opportunity to book Johnny Valletta given his performance as a strong machine and as a Masquerade member, and then given what he normally does? That is a man who would be ripe for the heart of Mike Quackenbush. Can't you just see Johnny Valletta in Chikara, at the peak of Chikara?
Oh yeah.
Doing the same thing he's doing in Dragon Gate And then every 6 months, Quackenbush would put him in a wacky mask and be like, I wonder who that is.
Yeah, he'll be doing like a long feud with Brody Lee. But yeah. Then also, guess what? He is actually Super Worker Ant.
Mm-hmm. You know? No, that's bingo. I couldn't have given a better analogy there. You're exactly right. I was thinking, I was like, God, Quack would have loved this guy. He does all the things that Quackenbush likes. It's so funny. I have two big picture questions for you on this show.
All right.
What was the thing on this show? Because I have a very specific answer for this. I'm curious if you do. What was the thing on this show, the nostalgia grab, that you found Dragon Gate had the hardest time duplicating on this show? The bit of nostalgia that didn't play.
I would say the thing that kind of, at least for me, when it was booked, I was like, okay, I wonder how they're going to kind of do this and how it's going to get played out. And it kind of ended up being the exact opposite in a way that wasn't really nostalgic, was the RED and Masquerade thing. I thought that the way that they kind of, it felt like it could have been Shun Skywalker addresses his enemies, especially with having Diamante, Hyo, and Yoshioka as Daya on one side and having to deal with Dragon Daya as a teammate and having like him go through it. But instead, it became a way to enforce like further December 1st, 2021 trauma on Dragon Daya. And I enjoyed it, but it wasn't a nostalgia grab. It just felt like that Shun Skywalker was just going to torment Dragon Daya even further, and no one should expect a Shun Skywalker and Dragon Daya to be in the same unit in any stretch of the imagination for the next like 3 to 5 years. That was kind of thing that I was like, oh, okay, that happened. What was yours?
I have a much different answer, because I liked that. I my heart was made quite warm by the RED Masquerade stuff. My answer is Jason Lee in Maximum, because he's 5 times bigger than he ever was in Maximum.
No, that is true.
And it was distracting to me because, you know, Doi changes his hair for Matt Blanky, Yamato's doing the gimmick, Shun's got the
Yamato
entrance gear.
Actually got new tights made.
Hyo and Diamante are selling it pretty well.
Hey, Hyo had to cut a promo to tell everyone, hey, I'm evil Hyo now, so you need to boo me. Look what I'm doing to the stuff animal, boo me now.
Excellent. And my match of the night was Akatsuki versus Maximum. I thought it was the one bit of genuinely great wrestling on the show.
Yeah,
but Jason Lee's so big now, and I was like, I'm trying to think about little, you know, Maximum era Jason Lee, this flyweight that was, you know, running around with Masato Yoshino and Kaito Ishida. Yeah, nunchucks. It's like this is the biggest man on the roster. He could barely get through the doorway. He's so wide now.
He didn't even bother trying to find the Maximum tights. They don't fit no more.
No, why would he? It's a waste of a search.
But like the funny thing about that is, you're absolutely right about like Jason as the one, the feeling like out of context here. But then you had like I feel like I've been more critical of these Gated Nostalgia shows, the first one last year and this one, in that it feels a little bit like, hey, remember the great times, the Remember Berries kind of thing with this. But Shingo putting on the singlet again and having like that sequence with Dragon Kid ending with the Mysterio Rana, like that was like, okay, well, next time Shingo wants to come play with his old friends and wants to kind of do this, that's when we bring back Gate of Nostalgia, because that's exactly the kind of nostalgia I was hoping for with this. And then you saw him and Benkei have a face off, and then your brain goes, oh, we really never got Shingo versus Benkei. And I was just off to the races in that semi-main event, because Shingo just brought it and was willing to kind of go through and go like, no, I'm going to have a Dragon Gate ass match, and I'm going to have my incredible chemistry of Dragon Kid, because that's never went away. That kind of chemistry never goes away. And at the end of the day, on a show that had things that made me laugh and smile, this was the one thing that I felt like actually kind of was worth like going like, okay, Shingo's go tell Joe and Rich. Shingo put back on the singlet, and it feels just like you're watching like a GIF from 2006. And it's amazing.
I agree with that completely. The thing that Gate of Nostalgia always makes me think about is not necessarily the, hey, look at when things were going better for us. It is a reminder of just how many people have left. When you start, like, I'm watching the show and it's like, well, you know, could they do Blood Generation? Could they do Italian Connection? Could they do this? Could they? It's like, oh no, like, the main characters of those units are gone. And they're not coming back. And it was just, you know, I don't look at that as a good thing or a bad thing, but rather just a thing. But it's definitely a thing where I'm sort of hit in the face with just the reminder of how many people have left and are now persona non grata.
Yeah, especially when you then have a unit like Maximum. And it's like, oh, that was Yoshino's last unit.
Yeah.
And he's, and when you think about Maximum, yeah, you think, you remember, oh, Dragon Kid was a part of it, but he's not one of the five members of Maximum that come to mind, really, you know? And then similarly, you look at how, like, you put everyone in, you take Yamato, Doi, and Hulk into Mad Blanky, because you have to have Mad Blanky on the show, just in the same way that you have to have the Jimmys on this show. And because you have to do those sorts of things, like, you couldn't do Berserk out of this, because why would you do Berserk when you already have the opportunity to do Mad Blanky? So you're kind of forced into, like, the situation that, I mean, the Maximum versus Akatsuki match, I think, was the last thing that was announced for this. And you're really kind of in this scenario where you have to have, like, Masquerade be all about Shun turning on Daya, and that being the storyline of that match, get yourself out of it, and your RED team has to be Hyo, Diamante, and Daya Inferno. And really, like, let's be honest, when you think about those units, I think about Hyo in that unit, and you think about how great Diamante became in RED, but that's not who you think about with RED. You think about Eita, Ishida, and Pac, and you don't really have that. And I do get that side of the coin you present, for sure.
I'm assuming they're going to do this again. I would prefer they keep it at Shinjuku Faith, because I thought the atmosphere for this show was quite lively. I did mm-hmm. enjoy that, but I would wonder if going forward, if Eita is the big get for a Gate of Nostalgia show, or what, you know, what they would do, because we've been under the assumption that it's not that either party necessarily wants to go through that door, but it is an open door for Eita if the right scenario were ever to occur. And I don't know if that is a serious role or if that's a Gate of Nostalgia role. And then you got to kind of go through, you know, okay, let's go through the list. Well, I mean, I would freak out. I would love it if Eita came back to do Flamita and UT and the Millennials, but I don't think they're going to do that. You can't do Overgeneration. I mean, you could do he and Dragon Kid as a tag team, but I really don't want to see that. And
I don't think you touch Overgeneration or any unit that has Shima fingerprints.
Yeah, yeah. No, that seems like it would be an uphill battle. So yeah, you're talking about doing RED, which I guess if you do RED with Eita, Hyo, and Diamante, I mean, that has my attention. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't really care one way or the other, but I'd raise an eyebrow at it at the very least.
Yeah, and I think that on the other hand, doing these kind of shows and doing Gate of Nostalgia, you also consider with what do they usually do in Shinjuku Face? It's either Buyuden or it's Shun Skywalker's show with it, and maybe it's a situation where, you know, Buyuden, since there are those outside wrestlers, and yeah, it's not like most of them are claiming like huge paydays, but it does, like, if you're looking at like real, like outside, I mean, it's Shingo, it's Kondo, and it's Awashi coming in on this show. Like, I guess Arkin technically, and maybe that is also like a more prudent kind of business thing. But I do wonder, what is the opportunity cost of doing Gate of Nostalgia versus other ideas? Because we've seen this idea a couple times. I agree with you. This is kind of a good fill in for like this kind of venue show. But if it's between this or Buyuden or Shun Skywalker produce or something completely new, I think I want the Skywalker produce or something completely new. And this is something you save until you can get your Shingos or your Atas to come back in there, because there's only so many times you can do Jimmy's versus Strong Machine Army, you know, like the, it did kind of have like that kind of air on the undercard a little bit, where it's like, oh, you know, Yagi is still here, so he can be doing comedy matches.
Yeah. I mean, on the, you know, the undercard was the Strong Machine stuff did nothing for me. I mean, I was ready to get to after the opening match, which was short but fun. I mean, there's a lengthy bit of time before you get to the finish of RED versus Masquerade, which was fun, and then, you know, the final two matches, which I enjoyed quite a bit. If you were going to sell me on the idea, and I can't remember, was there a Buyuden show this year?
Yeah, much earlier this year.
Let me figure out the question real quick.
They had a Buyuden as of July.
That's what it was. Okay, and that was Tanaka versus Jun Mas. Okay, all right. Yeah, this was a fun show. So, you know, if you wanted to sell me on the idea that you're going to do a quarterly show at Shinjuku Face, and one of them is a Shun Skywalker produce every year, and one of them is a Mochizuki produce every year, then you want to do Gate of Nostalgia, and then whatever that fourth show is, you know, my gut would be some sort of Monte Flamita produce, you know, Lucha Libre in Japan show, almost like if Tokyo Garantai didn't suck, would sort of be the spin I'd go for on that.
Get the Panther Brothers back in. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Bandito. You know, if we could just expect, and I guess maybe, you know, we'll see as the calendar unfolds for 2026 what it looks like, but if we could expect a quarterly Shinjuku Face show, and one of them was Gate of Nostalgia, and then we got some other fun produce shows along the way, I'm okay with that, because I don't think this show, I mean, this show wasn't great, but I think the Maximo Makoski match was a borderline notebook match. I went 3 3/4 on it. I really liked it. And the main event was fun at the very least. This was
great,
you know,
last fall. The last fall was great. Yeah.
You know, it really, the ceiling of it wasn't that much different than these Buyuden shows have been. I thought the Shun Skywalker produce show, I mean, I thought the main event of the Shingo Hiromu Bushi versus Shun Minoru Hamari match, I mean, I thought that was 4.5 stars. So the ceiling on that was a little bit higher than anything on this show. But realistically, it's not all that different. There is an added weight to this show, which I think is both a good and a bad thing. You know, it's Gate of Nostalgia, and you have all these units from yesteryear, so people are paying attention. But I also do think it leads to the, hey, remember when things were great, or wow, a lot of people are not here anymore conversation. So there's a bit of a weight to it that I think is an unintended consequence of doing these shows. But if it was just a, you know, once a year quarterly thing at Shinjuku Phase, all right, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, and I did like the idea of having an opener where it's like there's no reason why they're going to rehash a Big Hug or Gold Class or any of those. So let's send the six young guys out here. And if people are coming back and seeing a Dragon Gate show for the first time in however long, because they want to see Matt Blanky or Maximum, then maybe, you know, you catch a look at Jackie Kamei or Mochizuki Jr. Like, hey, I like this kid, I want to come back to the show. So I felt like that opener actually could end up being useful down the road for them to kind of do that when it was just kind of thrown together. I thought that was really smart.
Yes, I agree. I feel like the future of these shows, if I was going to book them, would be to integrate some of those guys into another unit, and that sort of be the draw of this show. You know, let me see Jackie Jimmy Kame, or let me see Kazuma Kimura do like Shingo spots and Berserk or something like that. It would almost be like the night of cosplay would be the thing that I think I would be more into at this point.
You know, which is funny, because like there are, and it happens a lot more in the Joshi scene, they will, it's called costume change battle royal, and like they will do like, okay, guess what, Konami, now you have to wrestle like Hanan, and you're wearing Hanan's gear, and that kind of becomes a little bit of thing of it. The one thing that they probably will end up doing is, I think we could safely circle and write down Strong Machine S as a future member of the Strong Machine Army after that opener, right? Like Sahara's got to do it one day or another.
That does feel like a safe bet.
But yeah, even with the Strong Machine Army, we got the good joke of Johnny Valletta as Giant Machine and the mask not fitting. That was funny, but then the match still went on.
Very much so.
But yeah, if that was Gay Nostalgia, my written review will be up sometime tomorrow. But Case, I think that's going to do it for us. Next time you'll be hearing from us, we'll be entering 1995 in those days, but we'll be back. Actually, that will end up being after Thanksgiving with a King of Gate update and getting us all ready for the finals and the semifinals and finals happening in Cork and Hall. But buddy, do you have anything else you want to touch on before we're out of here?
I don't think so.
All right. Y'all can follow us on social media at Open Voice Gate. Case is on Twitter at underscore in your case. I'm on Twitter at Fujiheya. We talked about the Voices of Wrestling Discord. It is the best place to join the conversation talking about Dragon Gate. Case, we were trying to decide who should be the next combat mode unit, and I think it should be Love and Peace.
I agree with that completely. I did not participate in that conversation, but I saw that, and I completely agree.
Yeah, I mean, Hio's going to wear the cat suit, and Rita just shows up in a rash guard and shorts. It's perfect. Rita doesn't have to dress up to be in combat. He's always in combat, but that happens in the Dragon Gate channel. There's also Matches of the Week by Angry 216 talks about Oedo style versus Nanawa styles. We've been really into our bullshit lately in the Dragon Gate channel, but also, and this will be important for next week, the Open the Voice Gate channel. That's where we post all of our show notes. Whenever we do a historical show, we make sure that all the matches and everything in our notes are posted there, and that'll be important for next week with those days, where we will have what we cover in 1995 for Michinoku Pro there. But there's also the Holy Bible of Open the Voice Gate, the pen tweet with Case's spreadsheet of all of our historical shows. If you like those days and you want to kind of get into either the history of Dragon Gate USA or deeper into Lucha Res, that's a great resource for y'all. But we'll be back with you next time talking those days. We'll be back later this month closing out King of Gate 2025. Take care, everyone.
Hello, Voices of Wrestling listener. Dave Ryan here. Have you ever wondered to yourself, how many hidden gems are hidden away inside the last years of World Championship Wrestling? Have you ever asked yourself how many tenuous gags can be made about the name Mike Enos? And have you ever thought about what it sounds like for two Irishmen to interpret a very chaotic company through its B-show? The answers to all this and more are just a click away. Check out Days of Thunder every second Thursday on the Voices of Wrestling podcast network.
Hello, do you like New Japan Pro Wrestling? Are you a Shin Nihon freak? If so, check out the Super J-Cast with Joel and Damon on the Voices of Wrestling podcast network.
And even if you fucking hate New Japan Pro Wrestling, listen to the Super J-Cast anyway. Not just for our great show reviews, analysis, and pastrami sandwiches, but there's also usually some dick jokes somewhere in the obligatory opening 30 minutes of absolute nonsense we chat about every single week. That's the Super J-Cast for all the best talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling, crisps, and pornography.